The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill and Fred end up in violent agreement. John gets sexual orientation thrown out of the clearance process. Maria can make it anywhere, and she proves it. Jennifer gets power and data from AI. More fraud, spies, and lies, and a pitch you will not believe. Or will you? Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
August 15th is our annual Go to Angel free-for-all. Any startup can pitch for free and get a 30-second slot on The Cyber Show. You have to fill out a G-Wiz before you can record, and you have to show up live online remote for the event in order to get on the radio show. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co. This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Welcome, Norman and Tony. Tell us what the name of your company is and what you do.
Okay, everyone. So we are Aqua Sensing. We are a Canadian-based startup, and we've just developed the world's first and only battery-free water leak detection solution.
Battery-free detects water leaks. Obviously, I guess you can do this with a piece of paper, and when there's a leak, and then the paper turns colors, but that probably wouldn't be very helpful to most people who aren't sitting there watching the paper all the time. So there must be a cyber element to this. So what's the cyber element?
In our solution, and we can generate electricity. We can harvest the energy from water, okay, send out a wireless signal to the cloud and back to the customer.
All right, so let me just get this straight. So we have something with no battery. Mm-hmm. It's harvesting energy from water. Most of us think of water as something that, you know, you put out fires, you know, and start them. Right? So, but you're somehow harvesting the energy from the water and using that energy to then communicate that you found water. Is that right?
Exactly.
Without getting too technical, how exactly do you harvest energy out of water? And why don't we start just doing that for all of our energy needs?
The energy we can harvest at this moment is not huge, but sufficient to send out a wireless signal.
So how much energy are we talking about here?
We're talking about a few watts and about up to 10 milliamps.
10 milliamps, a few watts. Okay, so 10 milliamps, so it's really low voltage, right?
Right. Let's say 2 or 3 watts.
Yeah, well, that's just enough to trigger enough of a radio signal to say, hey, I found water, right?
Exactly.
Now, just for clarity, when you get the signal, it's not like I can do it again and again, right?
No. It's we mark it as one-time use.
And is it not possible to have it do it again and again? Or can I three or four of them in one package? So when one goes off after it sends the alert, it waits until things dry up and then it shifts the next one into place?
Yes. For one, we can repeat like using a few times, but we don't want to mark it that way.
When I watched your video, what I saw was, you know, one of the uses of this is to put it in areas where you have pipes, but it's in the ceiling, so everything's closed up. So I guess the point is, if it detects the water there, you're going to want to replace the device, but you're going to be opening up the ceiling anyway, right?
To fix exactly, exactly.
Okay, so as soon as it detects water, you're going to have to go to wherever it is, regardless of where it is, and fix it.
The water damage is, tens of thousands of dollars minimum. And yeah. Nobody cares about the $50, a detector.
So now you can just spew these throughout a building, for example, have it inside the walls, under the floors, in the floor joists, up above the ceiling, wherever you want it, wherever there's a pipe, and detect water and then know that something's going bad before it drips through, right?
Correctly. Because most pipes are behind walls, what we see is only a small percentage of the pipes.
So now, in addition to that, in our house, we had windows that ultimately leaked, or a roof leak or whatever it was, but the the water came down into the walls. So there are other places you could put this in the walls, at joints, near roofs and things like that. So you could detect water before it does a lot of damage, right?
Excellent. And we also, detected the rain, let's say, seep into the house.
We also have sump pumps. So when the sump pumps fail, it's very exciting in our house because you don't know it until you suspect it. And then you walk down and you're in a pool. So our basement is like a pool. It's only a couple inches deep the last time we saw it. We'd like to do it before that. So these kinds of water detectors you could put next to the sump pump. So if a sump pump fails, you'll detect it. Yep. Next to the laundry. So if the laundry starts flowing over, you detect it under sinks, under refrigerators, and bathrooms and so forth, right?
Right. I did that for my home.
And did you have a leak?
Luckily, no.
So it didn't work. Okay, it didn't. It only works if something goes wrong, right?
Exactly. This is the insurance, right? This is an emergency alert. No news is good news.
Okay. Now, just tell us what mechanism you use to harvest energy from water.
Basically, number one, there's a lot of energy in water. Think about that one. And compared to ice, right? Ice is in a low energy state. Okay. To melt ice, you need to heat it up. So that's energy. Okay. Potential energy in water. And now we develop a special material, nanomaterial, micromaterial. And those material, when they in contact with water, they will interact with water. Okay, draw energy out of the water.
But it's not a chemical process. It's not like you're adding water to something else that then causes it to bubble up and that generates
the energy. No. It's more like a physical reactions.
Yeah, it's a physics issue at the nano scale, at the scale of molecules, right?
Right. You could say that.
Yeah. Well, I did say it. All right. So now when you develop this stuff, why don't we just, like, for example, for emergency power, have something like this. So if you're stuck out on the ocean, I don't know if you just saw the guy that was rescued after 3 months on the ocean because his.
Yeah, I saw the news.
Oh, my goodness. 3 months on the ocean. And apparently he's with his dog, so he wasn't lonely.
Mm-hmm.
He's okay. But you can imagine in circumstances like that, you might have some need for emergency power just to be able to generate enough signal for the, help I'm here thing, right? So.
SOS signal.
All right, but we couldn't use it as the new power generation, right, to replace solar or something like that. You just can't just put these things in the ocean and have them keep generating power, right?
No, this is for emergency use.
And the other thing is, because of global warming, apparently when you take the energy out of the water, it cools it, right?
Yes, in theory.
It has to, right? That's how physics works, right? If you take energy out, it has to reduce the temperature. You're reducing the amount of motion in the water. That's where you're getting that energy from, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so if we, but it's not feasible to take huge sheets of this, put it in the ocean and counter global warming, right?
No. Not at the current form.
Now, how about humidity? If there's high humidity, will that generate enough energy to trigger it, or do you have to actually have it underwater?
Okay, for this material, we need water. Okay, we do have other sensors we call the moisture sensor. They can also generate electricity, but right now they couldn't generate enough electricity to send out a wireless signal. We're working on it.
Well, you could have bigger ones, right? You could have a whole bunch of them, and combined they'd put out enough energy, right?
Very good, Fred. Very good, actually. Right now, what we do is we can activate Bluetooth, low energy, right? So we do get the questions, how about activate other wireless protocols like Zigbee, like LoRaWAN? My answer is yes, right? Of course, we need to redesign a little bit. And even without a major redesign, we can put many of them together. It's just like when you use batteries, right? You put them into series, parallel, right? You can have a higher
parallel for more current, series for more voltage. Yeah, I'm an electrical engineer by education.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't just a guess. One other question. So now, as a business, you're selling these through resellers, right? It's not something that I can just buy at retail and put it in my house and have it attached to my wireless, right?
We focus on B2B for now. And, you know, we can pursue B2C later on. This is the device I'm holding, you know, in front of me, right? And,
yeah, we're on the radio, so.
Oh, okay.
Let me show you. No, well, sorry, that doesn't work.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Full of double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. The grifters of the internet recently released their large language model scam machine. It automates many scams and personalizes them to the target. Meanwhile, the security researchers are awaiting permission to build defenses and grant funding likely to come in 6 to 9 months. It seems that innovation in defenses is stifled by paperwork while innovation in threats continues to grow. And that's breaking news on the Cyber Show. August 15th is our annual Go to Angel free-for-all. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years.
Let's look at a major cost to us today. The major victims of ransomware are schools and hospitals. And I say to the hospitals, we need to do a couple of things. We need to implement least privilege. We need to structure our networks in such a way that internet-facing things are separated from patient-facing things. We need to use end-to-end application layer encryption so that we hide a lot of generality and flexibility from everybody, get away from the flat networks. We need to do that, and it's not very expensive to do, but it can greatly reduce our exposure to ransomware.
I agree with you, but I cannot find a hospital that's willing to even talk to me about starting to think about how to deal with it.
Well, my goddaughter is married to a man who was the chief of medicine for the University of Pittsburgh. He managed 40 hospitals around the world.
Yeah, UPMC is a fantastic medical system. Yeah.
Right. You know, when I questioned him about his security, he had pretty good answers. Now he's at USC. And
yeah. By the way, I attended both of those institutions, University of Pittsburgh for my master's and USC for my PhD. So near to my heart. Continue.
Well, if all hospitals were doing what he's doing, we wouldn't be having all these ransomware successes. And that takes me to another thing about ransomware, is that we need to have a different approach to backup and recovery. Instead of being able to recover a few files, we need to be able to recover complete applications, mission critical ones, in hours to days.
When you say a different approach, this is not a different approach, Bill. This is the approach we've had for a long time. People aren't doing it.
We need better software approaches. That the software we're using today spends a lot of time doing the backup on the assumption that recovery is not going to take a lot of time, because what we're going to be recovering is, as in the NOTAM case, we're going to be recovering a database or a file.
But Bill, business continuity is not just backups, right? You should be having, for any substantial system, you need to have enough redundancy so that, you know, if something happens bad in place one, place two, you know, you need to be able to survive a flood or a fire or a tornado or whatever other weather events happen. So you need to be able to survive that. And if you're not doing separations of content and proper backup and recovery and testing of recovery with timeframes and integrity verification of content in your systems, then you're basically guaranteed a failure. I mean,
you just described what I want to fix.
But when you say what you want to fix, this is not something new, Bill. This is something we've known about since the 1950s, 60s for sure. It's not new. It's just called, why don't we just do the things we already know how to do?
As you said,
you and I can do this forever.
I know. The sick thing is we agree.
Yeah, we are in agreement.
How can we convince them? That's the problem.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
But all of that kind of stuff is what was not the real big ticket item in most of these commissions. They were looking on how to do vetting in a way that we could afford and was it would meet a due diligence level of effort.
Reasonable, prudent.
Yeah, that you did, what you did was prudent and reasonable under the circumstances.
Right. And so this is where, like, Perseret got involved, and they came to this conclusion ultimately that sexual orientation was not a sound basis for clearance or not clearance, except, of course, if you lied about it, that was potentially a way you could be extorted, right?
Well, I was involved in that study, and the position that we took was the fact that someone was a homosexual, and that's all we looked at. It wasn't all of these other issues now today. As long as they didn't attempt to conceal that fact, in other words, they were open about it, then there was no reason to consider them a bigger threat than anyone else or a smaller threat than anyone else. It was the concealing of that status that subject them to blackmail and other kinds of persuasions.
Yeah, but when the rule was that you could not be in the military, if you were, then you had to conceal it if you wanted to be in the military. So you had a catch 22.
Well, that's right. It wasn't just the military. You couldn't work for the government. You couldn't get a clearance. I mean, that was a bar to getting a clearance. It wasn't an adjudicative guideline. It was a bar to getting a clearance.
So you had to effectively, well, I guess if they didn't ask you and you didn't tell, that was okay, but they asked.
Well, if they lied about it, they'd get away with it because there was no homosexual database. There was nothing we could check at the time that would catch that. Unless they had a criminal record and it was documented as part of a criminal record.
Is there such a database now?
No, not that I'm aware of. And in fact, they don't even ask that question anymore.
Part of what you and the folks at Perseret did was get rid of that question.
Right. Well, we hope we did more than that. We got rid of that stigma. Because as I think the record shows, as long as they conduct themselves in a way that we expect everyone else to conduct themselves, the clearance is not an issue. Now, what I mean by that is the other 13 criteria that lead to the acceptance for a clearance. Now, you know, that's changed over the years. For an example, when I first got into this business, there were only 10 criteria. Now there's 13. What was added was misconduct with cyber and computer security issues is now an adjudicated criteria. It has been for, you know, probably a decade or so.
So that's a really interesting subject. So let's start talking about the cyber behavior, because we did a study some time ago that looked at essentially all of the cases of turning behavior involving classified information. And one of the things that we found was that a lot of the cases, maybe most of the cases that we ever found out about, their turning behavior was detected. And the problem was not that it wasn't detected. The indicators were there. It's that there was nothing done about it. And that's the same thing that happened in a lot of the shootings, the school shootings and so forth. You want to talk a little bit about that issue, that the what you do about it? So you can detect it all you want. So what, right? Detect without response is meaningless.
Well, legally, I think this ruling is still active. When you start talking about detecting anomalies, for an example, or conduct that is anomalous, the problem is, if it's detected by a human, there is a reasonable expectation that human is in a position to cause further review. If detected by early technology, it was just a detection. It had no explanation necessarily, and someone had to be assigned. And if you remember correctly, one of the things I think that we found was that when you put in those sensors and what have you, and you start detecting anomalous behavior, your database fills up pretty quickly.
I guess there's a lot of anomalous behavior.
Anomalous, right. Fills up pretty quickly. And so there were sometimes bad habits like, well, let's just erase that. Do something else.
Yeah, right. Well, false detections, right? If you get too many false positives, you turn them off, and then you don't notice things. And of course, one of the attack methodologies is to induce lots of false positives so they retune things. But
policy hacking, right? Let's go back to the beginning of that, right? You know, and as John said, you know, if you're lying about something, then that can be used to compromise you. You know, the blackmail, I will expose your lying. So policy hacking is the number one topic for me these days, right? Because everything else, technology, whatever, business processes, it's all guided by policy, and it creates policy. And we can't leave that one alone. I was born in 1965. You couldn't not join the military. If you were gay in the United States in 1965 and that was discovered, you could be put into federal penitentiary at hard labor for the rest of your life. You know, after World War VIII, you know, when my son was born in 1995, there were still World War II concentration camp victims in prison because the gay population in those camps was retained. You know, we did not empty the camps. We got everybody out except the gay people, and we put them in prisons and kept them there for 50 years. Right? And this is how bad policy leads to bad everything, because, well, you know, they're acting weird. Well, of course, you know, they're shifty and hiding things because you made it illegal for them to exist. Your policy has created the problem, right?
So, you know, there are a couple of fascinating things. One of them is, you know, John and the team at PerSerec, and, you know, I know these folks, and, you know, I'll say they're all mostly or all old white men, okay, at the time. And they're looking at this and doing the job they're supposed to do. They are honest, sincere people, hardworking, and they do the analysis that says, sorry, all that crap that you thought was true is just wrong.
Right.
And they figured it out, and they stood by it. They did what was right. And I am absolutely certain that was in the face of a serious headwind.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Oh, yeah. But they said, no. I mean, look. Facts matter.
Right.
Right. We looked at the facts and all right. So that's thing one. Thing two is we're talking here about trust architecture, right? And because you can't get away from the notion that you need an architecture for trucks. And this goes back to what we've been discussing, you know, from lots of past sessions. You need an architecture for trust. You need to architect it. And you talk about policy hacking, you know, policy surrounding trust. It's not something where you just sort of throw something up and say, oh, zero trust, or oh, we trust them, or you know, because I like him.
Right.
And all this stuff, you know, about sensitive information being leaked. There's a trust architecture that has to be in place. And if you don't have that architecture, you see what happens, right? All sorts of crap. And now let's talk about, you know, the global shift. And I'm going to stay out of politics, but I do want to talk about the global trends towards authoritarianism, as opposed to, we'll call it capitalism. You know, the distributed, everybody sort of does what they want versus the somebody in charge.
Right.
And so what happens historically is people get afraid and they're willing to put trust into somebody that says, I can keep you safe if you just trust me with control. And people that want control get into those situations. And, you know, what you're supposed to look for is the person, you know, this is right out of Harry Potter, right? The one that wants to find, you know, wants to have the control but not use it.
Right.
And, you know, you have to have a serious drive to want to control things in order to get into those positions. And if you have that drive, it seems very unlikely that you're going to be, you know, ready to give it up. And that's sort of the miracle of the U.S. presidency over time, is that George Washington, given all that power, being told, we want you to stay indefinitely, says, no, I'm not a king. And, you know, that sort of learning, that sort of a guardrail is a rarity in history. But devising a trust architecture has to figure out how to do this systematically and be executed systematically, distributed among a lot of people. So it's a very tricky business, and I don't think very many people know how to do it.
Well, and you know that what was the phrase for it? I'm blanking the moment. You know, but turning to authority. You know, it just, you end up with neither. You know, the classical quotes. You know, if you want to, you know, give up liberty for security, you get neither. Right. And this reminds me of I was at a Kaspersky security advisor summit, Kaspersky SAS. In Tenerife, I think, and we were coming from this, you know, incredibly alcohol-soaked night, and back on a bus together with a bunch of Russians, and sitting next to this guy I've been talking with that evening on the bus back to the hotel, and said, you know, Putin just makes us crazy, right? And I think given all the alcohol and conversation to that point, just the most honest answer, he said, yeah, I know, but, you know, we just like someone strong and in power, right? And that hasn't worked out really well. Right. You know, 10 years later, you know, that nation is, you know, hasn't benefited from that, even from the protective practices this last week. Right. You know, you have no real trust architecture. It's all, you know, centralized and arbitrary. And then all of a sudden you have, you know, your unacknowledged mercenary force that's stronger than your own army marching towards your capital. Right. It's just bad security architecture from end to end, aside from everything else.
Yeah. So we talk about security. I'm going to stay in cyber as opposed to the general security or national security, but it's really hard to separate them because at the end of the day, cyber, you know, is sensors, actuators, communications, and control, right? And all of the influence operations around the world, which go after the body politic, are running through the cyber environment. I mean, it's really not a case of personally getting to know somebody. You know, at best, you personally get to know them over the internet. I mean, I've known and worked with you. It's got to be 15, 20 years now. How many times have we met in person? You know,
half a dozen, perhaps. Probably.
Yeah, maybe less something than like 10. That. Maybe it's a dozen.
Yeah, maybe a dozen. Maybe a dozen. Yeah.
Yeah. But we've spent enormous amounts of time together. So it's just the nature of all of these things that the cyber world is involved, which brings me to another interesting question. At least it's interesting to me. Suppose we determine, you know, say as a society or just personally, that this is rot, that the cyber environment that we have has created a lot of rot, especially the social aspects of it, not the personal communications, but the social media stuff. And suppose, you know, imagine that we just rotted, just, all right, we're going to get rid of it all. How would that transform our lives for better or for worse, if all the Facebooks and LinkedIn and all that stuff just went away. We still have GPS on our phones, right? We still have email. But none of this, you know, social media with its enormous, vast scale influence operations.
I think at the end of the day, we would lose an enormous amount, right? You know, there's something about it. You know, it's falling to the authoritarian tendency. It turns out people like to talk. Well, it's like, let's talk about porn for a second, right? Oh my God, there's porn on the internet. Right? You know, people like that, apparently. Right? You know, we can tell. There's lots of it, you know, and people access it. And
yeah, but this has to do with trying to control other people.
I understand. But we're talking, you know, the reason social media exists is because people like to talk. Like to talk a lot. They like to talk to each other, and they like to, you know, feel good because people are talking to them and so on and so forth. Influence operations and everything else, the security mess we're in is not because of it. It's because bad actors have determined, you know, a field that is completely unprotected that they can leverage. I think we need to put appropriate security mechanisms in place so that the average person in the average cyber arena, you know, can not be a walking billboard or target.
All right, but what are those mechanisms, right? So when you talk about, for example, the notion of identification, right? So we attribute actions to actors so we know who you actually are, or at least we have a pseudonym that can be gotten so we can figure out who you are, or the limiting the ability to act as more than one identity simultaneously, right? So you don't have people with 50,000 identities that are using this. So you know, what's the protection mechanism that you notion or suggest would change the leverage here?
Well, I think of three things, right? You know, so one is when I go all the way back to my first days on the internet and pick my, you know, secret internet handle so nobody would know who I was, I chose Chris Blask with no space, all lowercase. And it's really sneaky, right? Can't tell who I am. Yeah.
No, I chose FC.
All right. But that matches my personality, and I've taken that position throughout my entire cyber experience. And there's something to be said for that, right? You know, in a forum like Facebook, you really literally know who people are. And in other forums, you know, it's all handles and you can't really tell, right? And it's,
well, you know, you don't really know in Facebook either.
Well, but this is the thing. It's, you know enough, you know well enough to take certain actions, and less well, I think, in other cases. I my own experience, I look at where we all, like, a new social, you know, Blue Sky is out there now, or Mastodon or whatnot, and I look at these platforms that are all nicknames and anonymous. I mean, I can figure out who people are eventually, but it slows things down. So identity, you know, acting in a reasonably effective identity, not digitally DNA and everything else, but, you know, saying who you are and having people in a forum know who you are, has an enormous impact. You know, anonymous voices are what they are. Another one is moderation, right? I'm a big, huge fan of moderated environments. You know, not the entire internet. You know, if you want to say absolutely insane things, you know, online, there needs to be a place for you to be. But it doesn't necessarily be the one that I set up to talk with my friends about things. And this works, you know, even, let's take Facebook. If you make a or social media, if you post and people reply to it, you've created a conversational space. You typically can moderate that, delete people, delete comments, and so forth. And I think that's a great thing, right? You know, free speech requires, you know, some, you know, tending. It's not just, you know, every gardening, right? You know, you can't let everything grow everywhere. Someplace you have to have a garden, and have the tomatoes need sunlight.
Yeah. So who's in charge of the garden?
Well, like, again, lots and lots and lots of gardens. You know, if I create a Facebook post, now that's my garden for right now. And I will delete people. I'll delete friends right out of a conversation because.
Okay, but in the large scale, that's what the big corporations have done. That is their garden, right? Facebook is Zuckerberg's garden, and, you know, it's not working, right? So yeah, those smaller gardens where you actually know who people are, where you've dealt with them over a period of time. You know, the truth is, knowing who people are is not as important to me as getting to know them and interacting with them, because I think it's very, very difficult for fraudsters and for most of the influence operators to spend the time and effort to actually get to know people, spend the hours talking to them, discussing things, exchanging information, and make sense. I mean, unless you actually know what you're talking about, you can't have a sensible conversation with me for very long about cybersecurity before I say, okay, you don't know what you're talking about.
Right. And unless you know someone, you're not exactly sure what the words they are saying mean, right? You know, somebody says blue in a context, it means one thing, and somebody says, a different person says blue in the same context, it means something else. Right. Yeah. I guess it would change my third one. I think I think automated attestation ecosystems and open systems like that again are not trying to make every social media post forensically. We're not talking about that.
What we mean is attribution of actions to actors.
Right. It's to the point that matches our normal human social environment. You know, so people have a general reasonable workable belief that what they're hearing or what they're hearing it from is probably who and what it looks like. Yeah. And I think security people be wrapped up around the 10,000 percent. We got to get the real life isn't like that. If you wanted to fool me, walk up to me physically and tell me you're somebody else, it's not that hard. You just probably won't, right?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There's an issue of scale, which is problematic in the internet. But that aside, I do think cybersecurity people just go too far. That is, they don't understand, the nature of risk, this notion of both good and bad things, right? Risk is the uncertainty about the future. It's not just anything bad has to be extinguished.
And how much risk we all deal with walking down the street, and everything else.
Oh, goodness gracious. No. Not without the guards.
Right.
Oh, no. And you could trip on something. So they have to, have a machine in front of you that's leveling it out.
Well, the self-defense thing, I'm a sort of self-defense extremist. I think everybody has an absolute right to defend themselves. But again, I don't believe that there's a huge risk of, mob of people charging into my house in the middle of the night. But I know people who have guns above every door just in case. Like, look, if I lived in, some environment that required that, sure, I'd do that. But I think it's just absolutely overkill.
Do you think it might be a slight exaggeration of the fear response of them?
Yes, I think it might be. So anyways, for our purposes here, business purposes, cyber purposes, personal, get realistic about your risk environment, make the right choices, reduce it.
Reasonable and prudent.
I wanted to say that as well. Did you learn that from John? Because I learned that from you. Use that.
Well, yeah. So no, I didn't learn it from John, but I learned it by trying to figure out what would be better than, best practice, crappy practices, good practice. And I come across it because I do litigation work. And so I've come across it in terms of liability, right? So your gross negligence is this, thing where you're not reasonable and prudent or where you maliciously and intentionally do something wrong. A regular negligence is failing to be reasonable and prudent, depending on the circumstance. But figuring out what those words meant, I went into the legal literature, and then I sort of came up with my understanding and explanation, and it has made things a lot more sensible.
Yep.
Especially in this trust architecture realm, where people talk about zero trust, which is just unreasonable. You can't actually do it, and then unlimited trust, which is the other side of that coin, which doesn't work either, right? I mean. You say, okay, we don't, our password is password. It's on the internet and we publish, when you'll come up to the site, it says, if you want to take over the site and modify things, log in and type the password, and then you can do whatever you want. That'll last a few minutes, maybe if you're lucky. So somewhere in the middle, right?
On Tuesday, August 1st, join our free monthly advisory session at 9 a.m. Pacific time. For more details or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
We're talking to Maria, who is one of the early women in the cyber world. She's had an amazing career starting as a programmer, and let's see where she goes from there. We could spend the rest of our lives talking because obviously we have so much fun at it. But before we finish up, because we're running out of time, I want to talk about what happened after Surveillance Grid. Where did you go to the other side of the country?
So there was this... It happened by chance. I was looking for an electrician on Indeed, can I say that? Because we needed an electrician for another project because we were kind of spread thin. So I went on Indeed, and so I was typing in smart city electrician because this is a special electrician that you have to hire that knows how city poles work. right? And I typed in smart city electrician, and what came up was this job opening in New York City to do exactly what I was doing, but in the city of New York. So I looked at it, I contemplated it. It sat there for about 2 weeks, you know. And then I finally just said, you know, I'm going to put my resume together, and I'm going to see if I can, if this is something that that I have, you know. I don't have the big city experience, but then who does, right? Who has the big city experience of New York City? No one. And so I put my resume in, and I got a call right away. And I went and interviewed, and it turned out I was the only candidate that actually had hands-on experience with IoT. In other words, you know, actually had gotten up on a tower, deployed something. You know, I it wasn't just theory. I actually designed them, deployed them, maintained them, the whole, you know, nine yards. I went to New York and was the 10th employee hired into New York City's newly formed agency called New York City Cyber Command. And I was responsible for the cybersecurity posture of all IoT being procured and deployed in the city of New York.
Which is all cameras, all sensors, all license plates, all the community,
everything.
The whole thing. Okay. So now this is like the big job. Yes, and now, you know, oh my gosh, I'm in charge of the whole thing. And of course, not enough resources, no funding, you know, no managed support, right? So tell me how that went, because you're not there anymore.
Right, right. So I got there, nothing existed. So I actually basically hired the team and developed the team, because a lot of the talent I needed, I needed people who had a good foundation, but that what they were still willing to learn. So I hired the team, put them together. We wrote the policy and the standards for IoT even before NIST came out with 802.13. And as a result, I was invited to participate on 802.13 because I actually had done that for the city of New York. So basically put the entire program in place for technology to be, how technology was to be ingested into the city of New York, tested and deployed. So
did you ultimately get in charge of all the traffic systems, traffic lights, the IoT and the water, the operational technology and everything else?
I did. I worked with, the challenge of my position, the biggest challenge of my position was working with agencies that I did not have governance over, right? So the Cyber Command was responsible for the cybersecurity posture of the city, yet each agency is independent. So you had to, the hardest job was this, you know, now it goes 360 back to the sales and marketing. the hardest job I had was selling what I was trying to do or stand up, right? The organization I was responsible for, and getting the agency CISOs and CTOs and CIOs to see the value of what I was doing. So, my first job was actually kind of made everything. The first thing I tested made everything else easy. It just so happened that the city was about ready to change all their analog parking meters to digital, right, to IP based, and so that was the first thing that came through my. After I set that up, actually, I was still setting things up. I was still setting up, and I had two team members at the time.
You and two other people implemented cybersecurity for all of the parking meters in New York.
In New York City. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. There's a little project. Okay.
There's a little project. So, so I had my lab, you know, what I call the lab, I was talking to the CTO, the CISO, and the director of the parking program for the city. And they're like, okay, well, how are we going to test this thing? And I said, well, can you bring one over here? So they wheeled in a parking meter and brought it into the lab. We hooked it up
and broke into it
in less than 3 minutes. And the only reason, the only reason it took 3 minutes is one of my guys had to, told him there was a hardware store around the corner. And I said, let's go see if we can just find a key to open up this thing at the local hardware store.
Of course you did, right? Of course. Right, absolutely. Okay. That's the first problem.
So it was pretty funny because
so what did they do? Change all the parking meters?
There's a whole backstory behind this, and we'll have to go offline on that one. But so they dropped off the parking meter, right? And the director like the bridges and tunnels are, you know, there's a director that runs all that. The parking meters, there's a director that runs all that. The digital signage, right? There's a director that runs all that. So anyway, so she gets to her office and she already has a message from me saying we broke into it.
She got back from leaving the meter off. She couldn't get back to the office before you had succeeded. Okay.
We physically broke in using a lock that we bought, a key that we bought for $5 at the hardware store.
Right.
Which gave us access to all the money and the innards of the
program. Yeah, right. You know, not to mention the electronic access to take the credit card information that they were.
That actually is the part that took about 3 minutes. My guy was able. After that great win, it was brought up at the highest levels in the city, and everybody wanted their stuff tested after that, pretty much. I mean, there was a couple of agencies that kind of came in kicking and, you know, still screaming, but for the most part, that kind of gave us our credibility almost right from the get-go. So
this show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
We're talking here with Jennifer Bayuk. Jennifer was one of the first chief information security officers on Wall Street and has a long and storied career before and after that. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you, Fred. Nice to be here.
Yeah, well, as opposed to not be here, I guess. There's no better place to be than on KMBY Radio.
And you heard it here first.
maybe only. So we were talking about AI and about how all of the different stuff existed in one form or another, although there was a breakthrough called Transformers about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe 8, 10 years ago, that made a big difference in the way all this thing is operated. But the big difference is in the quantity of data and the amount of computing power.
Yes.
And this then goes back to the fundamentals of information sharing and the breakthrough of the internet. So it might be worth talking a little bit about the security implications, not of AI, but of all of those other things where we had massive amounts of data connectable from anywhere and lots of computing power and lots of computers. Talk about that evolution.
I remember reading the Google privacy policy when Gmail first came out and thinking, how are they going to get away with this? They own all your email. I mean, that's what it said. And people didn't care because it was free. So their data became the great vast minds that were used to create models that could predict things like what your search pattern should be compared to me. And there was a great debate in the early 2000s about whether or not you should use the prior history of an individual for a search pattern, or you should just give them the facts, right? This is, you're searching for this. This is what that maps to. However, I get that nobody really knows the right answer to a search pattern. And the more you collect about an individual, the better you can get at predicting what they would want. But the whole making search easy that Google accomplished quickly became a maybe an unintended segue into the don't be evil line that you have to make sure not to cross if you're not going to harm people with computers, right? So,
well, but of course, that the unintended consequence issue comes up, right? So, So at this point, people are being harmed. But let's get real about this, right? So people have always been harmed by, you know, information and information protection about keeping people from being harmed from information, which is to say symbolic representations, right? And, but, you know, our whole society is based on this marketplace of ideas that we're all in. And, you know, people have been lying and, you know, doing frauds, and politicians have been lying and saying different things to different groups of people, certainly long before either of us were born, right? So the difference is presumably in their ability to amplify it and focus it and customize it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the concern that I think is not getting out there is that people don't know about the bubble. Back then, I would tell people, hey, from now on, when you do a search, it's building up your history, so you're only going to find more things that you already like. If you want to find things that are in your bubble, you have to change your search terms or go into a private browser mode so that you can find stuff that does not get crowded out by your own past history. And that is something people are completely unaware of, generally unaware of, that impacts how they see the world. They see it very much like them. And just a very simple example that really struck me hard is that I'm at a podiatrist and I have a very unusual foot problem. And I asked, like, what do I do about it? And, you know, stuff like this. And he's like, oh, just search for it in the internet. You'll find it. It's right there. I was like, no, it's right there for you. And if I search the internet for this problem, I am likely to get sold some talcum powder. So please give me the link, you know, please. They don't understand that you don't have that information at your fingertips.
Fair enough. But also the notion that somehow you should, a doctor telling you to trust the internet for information about your health is nuts, right? I mean, you know, they
put you and I, yes, to that doctor, and that was only like 5 years ago. It wasn't ancient history.
Yeah, I mean, part of the question is why did I bother to come to you if all you're going to tell me is to search? I mean, WebMD is available. It's not exactly, no tricks here.
The bubble, right? You know, this is an artifact of the time we're in. I think it's one of these inevitability curve things that we will get out of because we have to. It is so toxic that it has so many negative consequences. And, you know, people, the people who doubt the existence of influence operations quite often say, well, that would be so hard. You know, you couldn't, nobody has, well, look, it's just leveraging systems that exist already. We've allowed ourselves through convenience, me amongst us, to adopt systems that are easily exploitable against us. And that bubble is the main tool that's being exploited today.
So I find that very interesting. Of course it's true, but long, long time ago, I played one of the earliest computer games. We're talking about, you know, running on a PDP-5 long ago. And after that, I got an opportunity. I was working at Carnegie Mellon as a research whatever. And we had a PDP-11 or something. These are old computers for programmable data processor version 11. And so I started to play Star Trek on it in my, you know, not work hours because there I was, systems operator. Started to play and play and play. And I got to the point where I could win at Star Trek with my eyes closed in about 15 seconds. I mean, it was at the point where I somehow had learned everything you need to learn to beat the system. Somewhere around that point in time, playing games with computers ended for me. It was meaningless. And I have spent enough time on computers that I view them as a tool And it very simply a tool for finding what I want. And I know how to find what I want. And that's it. And when they change things so I don't find what I want, I change the way I search. But that's it. I use it to communicate, to find what I want, to deliver content to people, right? As a venue for authorship, sales, and marketing. All the things I use it for. But I certainly don't use it as my source of information for all things, right? I mean, it's a great source for all sorts of information and disinformation. And so figuring out where to look for reliable information, reliable and authentic information on different things is sort of fundamental to the use of it. And I think what happens to society over time is we just get good at that. Well, let me try it a different way. People that don't get good at it are dramatically disadvantaged and they become the lower classes. And people who do this well become the upper classes. And, you know, they get exploited at the lower classes and the upper classes get rich enough so they get exploited because there are plenty of criminals out there trying to exploit you. And it's the same in business, right? I learned over many years how to do business so that, you know, I don't get ripped off. And I've been ripped off. It's not that it's impossible to do it. It's that I understand the risks I'm taking, right? So I say, okay, I know I could get ripped off, but I'm willing to take the risk here, here, here. And over time, things progress. And this brings me back to Humphrey Bogart in the Maltese Falcon.
Everything should.
Well, you know, where the woman, the female lead says, I've been lying to you about this, you know, thing all along. And yeah, Humphrey Bogart says, I didn't necessarily believe your story. I believed your $500.
Right.
Right. So, you know, okay. So, you know, and it's the same way when you're doing business with somebody, you know, you can spend so much time and effort, but at some point money has to show up. And if money doesn't show up, then, you know, you deprecate it. You can still be nice and polite and reasonable. But if there's no money being exchanged, no value being exchanged, then it's not a business activity. And frankly, I don't go to the internet for friends. Right? I mean, you're my friend. I communicate with you over the internet, but I don't go to the internet looking for friends or love interests. And if I did, then I would currently be married to 15 Chinese young women who live in the Bay Area.
I'll add one counterpoint to that. I think, again, when I talk inevitability curves, some of them are very, very long, right? You know, it may not, you know, matter to an individual because, you know, things go past our lifetimes. And I think what you're saying about the bubble and search and efficiency is true in the short term. I think the short term stretches decades, right? I think in the long term, just the economic advantage of not having an underprivileged underclass that is inefficient and is exploited by an overlord class will drive, you know, better solutions. I think technically we can do it. I think we're being naive with technology and sociology right now. You know, we have two different groups of expertise. Technologists who say, well, all we need to do is put these five gears and this lever on there. Oh, wait, you know, we need to put a compensating control on there, or some cogwheels and a little spinny thing with brass balls on it. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, human sociology is, like we were talking about it in a previous segment, is massively complicated, you know, with, you know, very, you know, a whole string of zeros more than people expect. Right.
So I'm going to say that the arc of history does not agree with you.
History's short. Not much has happened yet in human history. We'll see what happens next.
Well, yeah, maybe. Well, you and I will only see so much of it, probably.
Right.
You know, we somehow live forever. But
working on that.
Not
very hard.
So I think what history shows is people get in positions to take advantage. They take advantage. They reach a level of opulence to where they just don't have to care anymore. And they remain there.
And the system will stay static for some period of time.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
August 15th is our annual Go to Angel free-for-all. Next week on The Cyber Show. John gets excited about pre-crime. Jennifer investigates Wall Street and AT&T. Roger spins his magic. What a tangled web we weave.
A new pitcher pours power out of water. Who's the magician now? More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.